From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was a history-making week for gay marriage at the Supreme Court, which struck down DOMA, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And it prompted 84-year-old plaintiff Edith Windsor to celebrate.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA. And those same children who happen to be gay will be free to love and get married, as Thea and I did, but with the same federal benefits, protections, and dignity as everyone else.
And the Senate approves a major immigration overhaul bill, sending it to the House, where its fate is far from clear. Here's Republican Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma.
Anybody that thinks that's going to be the final shape, I think, just doesn't understand what the political reality is. We can argue over the merit, but politically, that bill, as is not going to pass the House.
And filibuster Texas style, State Senator Wendy Davis succeeded in defeating an anti-abortion bill by filibustering for 11 straight hours, and the crowd went wild.
The hallway outside the Texas State Senate seemed almost like the backstage of a rock concert after the special session.
Today was democracy in action.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Gerald Seib of the Wall Street Journal, William McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, and our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. And joining us now from Washington is Gerald Seib, Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, where he writes the Capital Journal column. And Jerry Seib, welcome back to On Point. Great to have
Thanks.
You.
Thanks. Happy to be with you.
Also with us from Dallas, Texas, is William McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill McKenzie, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Good to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack. Always good to talk to you.
Hello, Anthony, Jerry, and Bill.
So, gentlemen, let's start with the big news out of the Senate yesterday, where lawmakers passed what's being called the most significant overhaul of the nation's immigration laws in a generation. The bipartisan Gang of Eight proved that bipartisanship can still work, at least in the Senate. Here's Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York.
The strong bipartisan vote we took is going to send a message across the country. It's going to send a message to the other end of the Capitol as well. The bill has generated a level of support that we believe it will be impossible for the House to ignore.
So the bill would tighten border security, would provide a path to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants, among a bevy of other measures. There's only one problem. As we heard in the introduction, House Republicans say they won't even consider the bill. So let me start with you, Jerry Seib. What's your take on this? Bipartisanship alive and well in the Senate, maybe not so much in the House.
I think that's exactly right. It's a big moment. This is the first time in a generation, in 25 years plus, that the Congress has gotten its arms in any way around the idea of really updating and reforming the immigration system. It's been talked about a lot. Until this week, not much really got across the finish line. But I think it is wishful thinking to believe this bill lives in the House. The opposition to it there, if anything, has gotten stronger. I think the proponents of the bill were happy they got close to that magic 70 votes in the Senate mark that they had hoped for, which they thought might provide some rocket fuel to get it lifted in the House. But I think the lift is very heavy in the House.
Bill McKenzie, do you agree with that?
Yes, and I'm disappointed because I'm not really sure I know what House Republicans are looking for. I mean, this bill, as we have read, has ample border security built into it. In fact, I would argue way too much than we need. I forget the exact price tag, but, you know, it's $40-50 billion, whatever it is. You know, we know that the border is more secure than it was 6 years ago or 7 years ago. We know people are still coming across. They aren't coming across in the way they were and the numbers they were before. So I'm not sure I know what House Republicans are really looking for.
Well, let me ask this. I mean, as I heard John Boehner this morning, is the problem that they want the border security measures to be deployed first before this so-called path to citizenship is allowed? And Jack Beatty, chime in here if you have a view on this.
Well, that seems to be what they're saying, that they want that to be a trigger. But, of course, that could take years. And, of course, in the path to citizenship itself is going to take more than a decade. That could tack on another who knows how many years. But fundamentally, I think the question is really about the Republican Party right now. And they have a choice. And the choice is, are they going to remain effectively a congressional party, or do they have will they allow themselves to have viability as a presidential party? And you know, if each of the Republican members follows his or her own electoral interest, the answer to the presidential party business possibility may well be no. Because if you look at these Republican districts, I think it's something like an average of 11% Hispanic voters in their districts, strong Tea Party disfavor toward immigration reform, even toward immigration. That's contrasted with what non-Tea Party Republicans want. They see the big picture, like Karl Rove. They see that if they're going to be a presidential party, they have to get right with Hispanics, the future of our country in terms of numbers. But following their own self-interest, the Republican House members may well cross that Rubicon and make it very difficult for the party to survive as a presidential party in the future.
Well, interesting indeed, the different responses by Republicans in the House versus the Senate. Interesting story. Let's move on, though, to three big Supreme Court decisions this week, which meant big victories for advocates of gay marriage, big changes to the Voting Rights Act, and big questions for the future of affirmative action. And let's take gay marriage first. The justices struck down the federal Defense of Marriage Act, which will immediately extend many federal benefits to legally married same-sex couples that are married in states where that is allowed. Here's Democratic Senator Nancy Pelosi of California praising the Supreme Court for that ruling.
With the decisions, the highest court in the land, the federal government will no longer discriminate any family legally married in the United States. California will join 12 other states in Washington, D.C. in recognizing the basic rights of all families. Equal protection will not simply be a promise unfulfilled. It will be a promise kept.
So, Jerry Tsai, what's your takeaway from these decisions on gay marriage?
You know, it is was definitely a day of victory for proponents of gay marriage. It wasn't the day of complete victory. The idea that the federal government could move in and essentially define gay marriage as invalid, that idea was pretty much thrown out in a 5-4 decision, and I think that was decided clearly. Obviously, the justices decided that they weren't prepared yet and didn't have a legal position yet that would allow them to make a broader ruling about what states could and couldn't do. But the effect of it was to sort of clear away the obstacles to gay marriage in California, the largest state in the nation, obviously, and to let the political process continue to sort through this. And the shift in the public opinion on this subject suggests that the political process will continue to decide over time in favor of gay marriage. So it was significant, but not absolutely decisive.
Yeah, and it raises some interesting questions that are going to be difficult to resolve. I mean, I was struck by something in doing the reading this morning that Justice Antonin Scalia asked. He wrote, imagine a pair of women who marry in Albany, where gay marriage is legal, and then move to Alabama, where it is not legal. Will they be allowed to file a joint federal income tax return? And in other words, does the answer revolve around where they were married or where they live? So Jack Beatty, still a lot of uncertainty as we move forward here, even though the momentum toward acceptance of gay marriage across the nation seems to be moving in that direction in a big way.
All sorts of complications ahead. The president in Africa in his press conference addressed them, and he said, we're going to try to smooth that out and take care of cases like that. That remains to be seen. You quoted Justice Scalia. I think his quote, he said something else that really basically said that the handwriting was on the wall for gay marriage in the future, because he said, effectively, if the, you know, he says, by formally declaring anyone opposed to same-sex marriage an enemy of human decency, this is Justice Scalia, the majority arms well every challenger to state laws restricting marriage to its traditional definition. In other words, if a federal ban on gay marriage is an affront to the Fifth Amendment, to human dignity, to liberty, as all the things that Justice Kennedy said, how in heaven's name can state bans stand? And of course they can't, but the question is, how long will it take? How many more people will suffer that affront to their dignity of being treated as second-class citizens in states that either have constitutionally or legislatively banned gay marriage? Mm.
Jerry, Bill, Jack, let's take a quick call from Lisa, who's calling from Boston. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. I'm calling from Boston to say that there is no such thing as gay marriage. there's no such thing as gay marriage because there's no such thing as Jewish marriage or black marriage or white collar marriage. It's simply marriage. And the longer we call it gay marriage, the longer it will seem like that's somehow different than marriage. This is about marriage equality. And I hope that, people will stop using gay marriage and simply say equality for gays and straight people to have marriage.
Lisa, take your point. Appreciate the call. And clearly, with yesterday's, with this week's decisions from the Supreme Court, we're moving closer to that day. But thanks for the call. We appreciate it. And gentlemen, let's move on to that more news from the Supreme Court, the decision on the Voting Rights Act. And the background of this, of course, the 1965 Voting Rights Act was a huge victory of the civil rights movement. But 48 years later, the Supreme Court struck down the act's key enforcement provision, saying essentially that times have changed. And the decision frees mostly southern states to make changes to their election policies without federal oversight. Bill McKenzie, let me come to you on this. I'm particularly interested because you're down there in Texas. What do you make of this decision? How significant?
Well, it's significant, and I'm glad they did what they did for this reason. The Section 4 that they struck down is the formula that would determine which states would be in Section 5, and those Section 5 states have to be pre-cleared for virtually any changes they make in their election laws. So, but Section 4 uses a formula that is largely based on data from about the mid-1960s. And I think, you know, so much has changed in America, but particularly in the South since then. Look, in Texas, we have had African-American mayors of all of our major cities, except perhaps one. We've had Latino mayors in our major cities. We have a gay mayor of Houston. We have legislators who are African-American, Latino, Asian-American. We have a senator who is Latino. So, you know, much has changed. Much has changed because of this Voting Rights Act, as Justice Roberts said. So, but I think it logically it makes sense to come back and update this data. Now, the question is, will Congress do it? And the answer is not willingly. So, you know, I don't like bipartisan commissions. I think Congress ought to do its work. But why don't we have a commission like we did on the Debt Commission or we had on the Base Closing Commission, where we have members from both parties pointed from outside, have you some law experts, have you business people, have you civil rights leaders, whatever, be on this commission, and they help to identify for Congress what these new standards should be. I think we need the standards. I think we're I'm not advocating we strike down Section 5. I'm not sure those nine states, I think it is, that are in it all need to be back in it. But we should keep Section 5, as the court said. We need new formula to determine who gets there.
Interesting. Jack Beatty, your view on what the Supreme Court did, which essentially gutted the enforcement mechanism of the Voting Rights Act. What's your view on this?
Well, you know, the principle they invoked was something called, quote, I'm quoting from the majority opinion, the fundamental principle of equal sovereignty of the states. That is, you were treating some states, you know, in a different way than you were others. According to Richard Posner, the appeals court justice, he says, this is a principle of constitutional law of which I have never heard. There is no such principle. He can find no such principle. And on the other side, what did they ignore? Well, they ignored the record. Now, Bill says the record that they thought was relevant only went to 1965. But as Justice Ginsburg points out in her exhaustive and I think persuasive dissent, Congress found that there were more objections under this provision between 1982 and 2004 than there were between 65 and 82 when the act was first reauthorized. She cites a host of these examples, all of which came out in the congressional testimony in 2006 of various kinds of racial gerrymandering, of other sort of second-generation devices designed or with the effect of excluding or minimizing black participation in the electoral process. And she, you know, she points out how it's, again, just going through the exhaustive record that was in Congress. And then the question says, well, that was 2006. What's happened since? She cites a FBI report on recording devices that were used by someone doing exposing the something a crime, I believe, in the Alabama legislature. Members of the state Senate derisively referred to African Americans as quote aborigines and talked openly of their aim to quash a particular gambling-related referendum because the referendum might increase African American turnout. Again, the examples are just overwhelming. They are not from 1965. And what they show, really, is that, in fact, things haven't changed in these covered districts. The devices used have simply shifted.
Hmm. I couldn't disagree more about the things have not changed. You have to live here and see what's going on. I think Justice Roberts made it pretty clear in there, and I'm doing this from memory, that in Mississippi, you know, voter participation in 1964 among African Americans was X. Now it is X plus 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 plus. So
yeah, I think the numbers I remember was something around 6%. Now it's up to 76% or something like
right.
that. I mean, dramatic numbers.
Right. And if you look across the South, you have many African Americans who are elected to local offices, who are mayors of cities, and state legislators. So a lot has changed. Also, what Ginsburg is referring to are violations that take place in those nine states and a number of municipalities. I'm not arguing that voter problems don't, irregularities don't exist. I've said I think we need Section 5. The question, though, is what triggers you going into Section 5? And that is still, that determination is still, was still largely made on participation in elections in the mid-1960s. Well, and my argument is we have changed a lot. This finds some new standards to determine who should be pre-cleared.
Let's take a quick call on this very subject. Lynn is calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. I'm calling because I was wondering, why can't there be some type of law passed where all of the states are placed in, I think it's pre-clearance, and meaning, you know, that in order to change any type of voting law within a state, it has to be approved by the federal government.
I think it's a great question, Lynn, and let me put it to my panel, because let's be clear about where the law sort of focused. It applied to nine states, mostly in the South, including Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, and Virginia, as well as parts of Alaska and New York and even New Hampshire. But clearly it's focused on the South. Jerry Seib, let me get you back into this conversation. Speak to the caller's question. Any chance that Congress would think about amending the law in such a way that, you know, it would treat this issue more uniformly across
well,
the country?
You, if you go back again to Justice Roberts' majority opinion, the one that struck down Section 4, he says in that opinion, our decision in no way affects the permanent nationwide ban on racial discrimination in voting found in the Act. We basically then invite Congress to rewrite the section that provides that certain states have special conditions, which is the special condition is basically you have to come to Washington before you change any voting procedures. And he invites Congress to reconsider and repass that part of the legislation. And he says, our country has changed, and while any racial discrimination in voting is too much, Congress must ensure that the legislation it passes to remedy that problem speaks to current conditions. The problem with that is that as currently constituted, I think Congress isn't capable of coming to a consensus on much less divisive issues than this. I just don't see any prospect that Congress will rewrite that part of the law. So I think you're probably in an era in which the part of the Voting Rights Act that in general says racial discrimination in voting is prohibited, the mechanism for focusing enforcement on specific states is dead, and I don't see it being revived in this Congress.
Mm. Well, we should move on to the third big case decided this week by the Supreme Court. So let's talk briefly about the affirmative action case in the High Court. This was a case examining the constitutionality specifically of race-conscious college admissions, in this case at the University of Texas in Austin. Now, in a 7-1 ruling, the justices did not address directly the constitutionality of the program, so it will be allowed to stand for now. But they did say that courts have to take a skeptical look at race-conscious affirmative action programs. Here's Abigail Fisher. She's the plaintiff in the Supreme Court case on affirmative action, Fisher v. University of Texas. She says she was pleased with the decision.
I'm grateful to the justices for moving the nation closer to a day when students' race isn't used at all in college admissions.
Bill McKenzie, let me start with you in Dallas, Texas, for obvious reasons. Your response mm-hmm. to this decision?
Well, I was glad they did not strike down the use of race as one of several factors that UT could use in some of its admission decisions. I was glad to see them not take that step. I think it's fascinating to watch the Roberts Court's work. It's kind of a nuanced approach to the law. They're taking one step forward, kind of one step back mm-hmm. at the same time. They're saying we're not going to strike it down, but you, the court, you need to look at this Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. You need to look at this more narrowly. You know, I think it's important for a state like Texas to be able to use race as one of many factors. Half of our public school students in Texas today are Latino, and I think we need to all the strategies we can have to making sure that African Americans and Latinos are represented in college. Having said that, it is important to note that Texas has a rule that passed after affirmative action was struck down in the 1990s that allows kids who finish in the top 10% of their high school class to have automatic admission to the University of Texas, which is my alma mater. And so you've seen UT have a much more diverse student body using race-neutral policies. I point that out in that I think we need both. I think we need creative race-neutral strategies, but I don't think it would be wise to strike down using race as one of several factors that UT uses in admission decisions for kids who don't get in through this 10% rule.
Now, let me ask one more question. Jack, I want to come to you with this. I mean, it sounds like basically Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote for the majority that before colleges and universities take race into account in their admissions policies, they have to demonstrate that available, workable, race-neutral alternatives do not suffice. So what's the effect of this decision going forward? I mean, is it likely to set off a series of challenges going forward?
That's what people say. And, you know, to look for that sweet spot, something that, in other words, the point where states have exhausted, universities have exhausted every possible race-neutral criteria and still haven't got sufficient diversity, to look for that that precise point is going to be a difficult search. Now, I heard the chancellor, the president of the University of Texas, say he thinks that what they have, with just a little tweaking, can meet this you know, more demanding standard, the strict scrutiny, as Justice Kennedy called it. We don't know. I just had the feeling in that decision that the court was preparing to eventually, and perhaps sooner than later, strike down affirmative action altogether in admissions policies, partly because they are there following public opinion. Public opinion has turned against affirmative action, which many of us think is a great shame that the people don't recognize that this is still necessary. And on the other hand, you see liberals saying, well, this is a moment when affirmative action can become a more equal proposition by dealing with economic disadvantage. That change the subject from race to class and give kids of any race who are disadvantaged economically the chance in life that all of us need. Maybe that'll lead to that kind of discussion, but given the polarization of politics, I can't imagine any legislative remedy.
Let's move on now to President Obama, who flexed some of his executive muscle this week over the issue of climate change. In a speech this week at Georgetown University, he announced a collection of sweeping measures to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. He pledged, among other things, to reduce carbon emissions by 17% by the year 2020. Here he is speaking at Georgetown this past Tuesday.
We limit the amount of toxic chemicals like mercury and sulfur and arsenic in our air or our water. But power plants can still dump unlimited amounts of carbon pollution into the air for free. That's not right, that's not safe, and it needs to stop.
President Obama speaking Tuesday at Georgetown University. And Jerry Seib, two issues here sort of strike me. First, that the president is seeking to take on this challenge in such a big way. And second, that he's going to rely on executive branch powers rather than congressional approval. What's your take on what the president did and said this week?
Well, I think, first of all, you're exactly right on the second. On the first, you know, the president said global warming was going to be a big second-term issue for him. You know, his critics in the environmental movement thought he didn't do enough, sort of dodged the issue in his first term. He had said, I'm not going to do that in the second term, and this was proof of that. However, as you note, this is not something where the legislative remedy seemed very apparent to the president, I think. The idea of getting big global warming, greenhouse gas reducing legislation through this fractured Congress didn't seem very bright. So he took the other path. He decided to go around Congress in this case. And he's doing that by using a lot of executive actions. The most significant of those was, and this was the biggest decision I think the administration had to make, was to apply the limits on greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants, not just to new plants, but to existing plants. That's the controversial one that's going to be fought in courts. That was sort of the sweet spot for environmentalists, and the president went right at it. As a footnote, the other interesting thing he said here was he kind of started to set up his next big decision on energy and global warming, which is the question of whether to approve or disapprove the Keystone XL pipeline, which brings oil down from tar sands fields in Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. And he said an interesting thing that has a lot of people scratching their heads trying to figure out what he meant. He said that would be approved if the pipeline doesn't overall increase the footprint for global warming of that kind of energy. Well, it's hard to know what that means exactly, but it may be that he's setting up a way to approve that pipeline by arguing that overall the way that would be done would be less harmful to the global warming question than having that oil go someplace else and be used in different ways.
Hmm. It's interesting, though, Bill McKenzie, I want to bring you back into this conversation. I mean, President Obama has been criticized by some for not being as sort of full-throated in promoting his policies and his values from the White House. He certainly did that this week around this issue, it seems to me.
Yes, and I would agree with Jerry. I don't think he has much choice but to do it other than through executive action. You know, so we're here in June of 2013. You know, he has basically about a two-year domestic window, if that, to get things done that he wants to get done. And so I think, you know, they did the course, pursued the course that probably is the most logical one, to use it through executive action.
Jack, your thoughts on the president. We have about 30 seconds left before the break, but I want to give you a chance to chime in on this story.
Well, yeah, last week on this program, we were saying, gee, the people in Europe, Vladimir Putin, others, they're not taking the president very seriously. He seems weak. Well, he comes back, and this is a major presidential act all on him. At the end of his first term, The New Yorker called him the James Buchanan of climate change. Well, he's setting out to change that right now.
We're talking about the week in the news. Stay with us, listeners. You can join the conversation. What did you make of Paula Deen's comments? How about that filibuster Texas style, the arrest of Patriots Aaron Hernandez? I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll take a short break and be right back. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, the world watched and well-wishers sang outside a hospital in Pretoria, South Africa, where an ailing Nelson Mandela still clings to life. And back here in the U.S., in a Today Show interview with Matt Lauer on Wednesday, a tearful Paula Deen insisted she is not a racist.
I can truthfully say in my life, I have never with any intention hurt anybody on purpose, and I never would.
And the Chicago Blackhawks rallied in the final minutes against the Boston Bruins to win their second Stanley Cup in 4 years.
Here's the captain, Taves, with an empty net, and he can't get it, but he's run out the clock. The Blackhawks have snatched victory from the hands of defeat. Chicago has won the Stanley Cup.
and ecstasy in Chicago, misery here in Boston. But what are you going to do? You can join the conversation. What are you watching this week? Are your thoughts with Nelson Mandela? And we're joined this hour by Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Bill McKenzie of the Dallas Morning News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And gentlemen, let's start. We heard that clip from Chef Paula Deen, whose Southern cooking empire seems to be crumbling this weekend. She's out at the Food Network. She's lost several big endorsements after her admission in a deposition in a discrimination lawsuit that she used racial slurs and tolerated racial jokes in the workplace. And what she said specifically was that she planned a plantation-style wedding with black servers, among other things. Bill McKenzie, what do you make of the controversy over Paula Deen's comments?
You know, in 2013 America, we just don't have time for sideshows like this. So, you know, I think Paula Deen is getting what Paula Deen deserves. You know, we need to move on as a country. We're not going to tolerate that stuff. We don't need, you know, there's not time and room for that. And so we have many more things going on in our country. So, you know, I think she's getting what she deserves.
You know, Jack Beatty, it strikes me. I mean, Bill was talking about a sideshow. I couldn't agree with him more. But it's sort of interesting where a moment ago we were talking about voting rights and where we are in this country around race, and then somehow to be sort of plunged into the sort of bottom feeding trough of this kind of story. It seems like a strange irony to me.
Well, yeah, it's in its own bottom, though. It's in its own trough.
I think that's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. I agree with you.
and her comment, I think, is priceless to today. She says, I is what I is. All right, you continue to be what you are, and all those companies. And by the way, note that all these major corporations saying, we can't have anything to do with a person like you.
Well, let's take a call on this issue. Leroy is calling from Monk's Corner, South Carolina. Hi, Leroy. You're on the air.
Hello, Anthony. How are you today?
I'm very well. What's on your mind?
I'm African-American, and I'm offended by racial comments. I think there's really no place for them. However, what really disturbs me more than anything else is that something that happened 30 years ago, you've got all these major corporations setting an example saying, okay, pull her endorsement. Was something that happened 30 years ago. What about my child that I had out of wedlock 30 years ago? Am I going to be punished for that for the rest of my life?
Yeah, so you would say accept her apology, move on, don't pull the endorsements, essentially.
Correct. Yeah. If it's 30 years ago, if it's the past that far back, why punish her today when this aspect of what she said and what she did was known for years?
Interesting point. Jerry Seib, I want to move on from this story, but speak to Leroy. What do you think of his point?
Well, look, I mean, companies that do sponsorships don't really do that because they want to engage in social commentary or controversy. They tend to run in the opposite direction in most cases. And I don't think that's a judgment about Paula Deen or anything she said or did. It's just a reflection of this is not the kind of headache that companies who get into this business are interested in. You know, so I guess in that sense it's not surprising, but I also don't think you can read much into it.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to a stirring story about democracy in action. Bill McKenzie in the Texas legislature. Wendy Davis, a Democrat where's she from?
From Fort Worth.
Fort Worth. Sorry. Stood and talked for more than 11 hours. Without sitting, without eating, without drinking, from what I read, she didn't even take a bathroom break. Her filibuster was to help block passage of an anti-abortion bill pushed by Republicans in the State House. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
If we were truly talking about women's health care, if we were truly talking about making sure women were safe after an abortion, this is the kind of thing that goes right to the heart of that.
That's Texas State Democrat Senator Wendy Davis from Fort Worth filibustering this week. So, Bill, she emerged thousands of Twitter followers. Sounds like she's a bit of a celebrity after that incredible feat of endurance.
Right. And it was. It was quite a moment in the legislature. I have to admit, I'm sorry I wasn't there. I've sat in that chamber many an hour, and this is kind of like following your team and missing them playing the Super Bowl. I mean, it was a big moment. I think a couple things going on here. Governor Rick Perry completely overplayed his hand by introducing abortion into this special session, which is what we were dealing with when she took to the filibuster. You know, and if you're going to introduce an issue like abortion, you really better win it. And he didn't. The Republicans in the Senate didn't win it. And so, you know, he overplayed his hand and he lost. That allowed Democrats like Davis to step in, seize the mic. She clearly has elevated her profile. There'd been hints way before this that she may run for governor. And so it's galvanized a lot of pro-choice people, as we saw the other night. But I think there's going to be a third element that's going to kick in here. And it's already happening, I think, is this is going to galvanize folks who are in the Perry camp and who are pro-life. And so there you're going to see this galvanizing a movement on both sides. The question I have is what this is going to do to moderates who may be in the middle, and particularly moderate Republicans who may be pro-choice, but, you know, are Republican on many other issues. So I think we're going to see these two forces play out. But it started with Perry overplaying his hand.
Well, Bill, I should have asked you because I'm actually interested in a little bit of background on this. What would the bill have done specifically?
Well, it would have limited abortion in Texas to the first 20 weeks of a pregnancy, except for two big exceptions, you know, the life of the mother and severe fetal abnormality. It would have subjected abortion clinics to a new level of medical standards found in surgical centers. It would have changed the way that abortion pills are distributed or handed out. And so those are the three elements. The part that probably got the most attention was the 20-week ban. But I think probably the most important part of it, or the part that was going to have the most effect, was the effect this may have on access to abortion clinics through these other standards they had to meet.
You know, Jerry Tsai, what was so interesting about this story, and I'm coming to you because you're there in Washington, we often hear about filibustering in Washington, but it's rare that a filibuster happens like that, the old-fashioned way. Right?
Oh, it is. I mean, filibusters in Washington happen because somebody threatens to do a filibuster, and then the threat makes everybody run to their corners, and then they figure out a way around it, except that Senator Rand Paul did the real thing here some weeks ago regarding drones, and that was interesting and considered exceptional, and this one was interesting and exceptional as well. You know, I think one of the things that struck me as I watched this is that people have said for a long time that if you want the surest sign of what separates Democrats from Republicans, look at abortion. And that's still, I think, largely true. The other thing that struck me, and, you know, Bill would know more about this than I, but this happens in a context here. Democrats are really trying to start pulling Texas back from all red status, trying to pull at least into purple status. A lot of people who worked in the Obama campaigns in 2008 and 2012 have migrated toward Texas because they think the changing demographics of the state make it possible to turn the state back into a Democratic state at least sometime over the next decade or so. And this is the sort of thing that, at a minimum, activates part of that Democratic base that may have been gotten a little lethargic over the last decade.
Listen,
I think, I think Jerry is right. And that's part of what I should have said about Perry overplaying his hand. He's given his opponents a way to go out and rally people.
Listeners, we're talking about the week in review. Jerry Seib joins us from Washington, bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal, Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News, and Jack Beatty from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst. Gentlemen, I want to move on, if I could, to sort of the latest about Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker, U.S. efforts to extradite him. He's still, from what we understand, in a Moscow airport. President Obama spoke yesterday in Senegal about this case. Let's listen.
I'm not going to have one case of a suspect who we're trying to extradite suddenly being elevated to the point where I've got to start doing wheeling and dealing and trading on a whole host of other issues simply to get a guy extradited so that he can face the justice system here in the United States. But let me, one last thing, because you asked a final question. No, I'm not going to be scrambling jets to get a 29-year-old hacker.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of that? I mean, on the one hand, the Obama administration obviously very committed to getting this Edward Snowden back to the U.S., but they're kind of in a tough spot here, because how do they do it?
How do they do it? It doesn't sound like Ecuador is exuberant about the prospect of him coming down there. Foreign Minister Lavrov of Russia yesterday said that we don't want him here. As soon as we're gone, he's gone, the better, so far as we're concerned. His father is quoted, Snowden's father is quoted today as saying he would come back subject to certain conditions, and one of them seems to be that he not be jailed ahead of any trial. So I don't know what will come of that. The president is being criticized, as the Washington Post points out today, for not using diplomatic leverage to get him and just letting the Justice Department handle it. But as the president just said, I mean, should it be the president's job to get on the phone to the president of Russia and say, look, I'll trade you a missile or two for this fellow? I mean, we do have laws in the world, extradition treaties and so on, and procedures. And it sounds to me as if China and perhaps now Russia simply decided not to follow them.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. And Jerry Seib, I'd like to ask you a little bit about this Snowden affair and just sort of, you know, where the Obama administration, where it leaves them, a sense, the challenge they're facing here.
You know, it's interesting because early on this week, and I wrote a column about this earlier in the week, there was a lot of criticism of the administration and a sense that the Chinese and the Russians had simply thumbed their nose at the U.S. and decided that better to please domestic constituencies than to listen to Barack Obama. And so they just sort of snubbed it. And I think that was true to some extent for the Chinese, although they also may have thought the best way to avoid a bigger fight with the U.S. over extradition was just to get the guy out of the country. I think it's interesting that there's now a pause, and maybe some of this diplomatic pressure, and there was and has been diplomatic pressure, maybe having some effect. You see the Russians not turning Snowden over, but not also making it easier for him to figure out how to escape the clutches of the U.S. And Ecuador is clearly thinking twice now about whether they want him around or not. So maybe some of this diplomatic pressure from the U.S. Has had some effect, whereas a few days ago it looked as if the U.S. was essentially feckless in this matter.
Gentlemen, I want to move on a little bit and ask you about the trial of George Zimmerman, charged with the murder of unarmed teen Trayvon Martin. It began to unfold in a dramatic way this week. One of the star witnesses was Rachel Jean Tell, who was on the phone with Martin just moments before his death. Zimmerman's defense attorney, Donald West, has been grilling Jean Tell, pressing her hard on her version of the story. Let's just listen to a little bit of that.
You don't know that Trayvon got hit.
He could. He had.
You don't know that Trayvon didn't at that moment take his fist and drive it into George Zimmerman's face.
Please lower your voice.
Do you?
No, sir.
Bill McKenzie, what are you seeing in this trial as it unfolds?
Well, the honest-to-gosh truth, it's a little bit like Paula Deen. I haven't followed it as closely because this is the week with, you know, voting rights, immigration, all these things going on. But what I have looked at, it seems like this attorney, correct me if I'm wrong here, this isn't the first time he has been pretty a little bit over the top in how far he is going in some of the things he's been here trying to elicit from her, but also I may be wrong here, but some of the jokes he may have cracked at the beginning of the case.
Well, we heard Judge Deborah Nelson there saying, please lower your voice. So, yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Right.
Was someone about to chime in there? I thought I... No, okay. Let's move on. I want to talk very quickly, finally, this week about Aaron Hernandez, a former tight end for the New England Patriots, charged with murder, accused of executing an acquaintance from Boston. The Patriots immediately cut him from the roster. In hearings this week, prosecutors said surveillance videos in and around Boston, even in Hernandez's own home, linked him to the murders. He's also being investigated now for another double murder. And I guess I'm struck by two aspects of this story. First, there's a long list of professional athletes who end up in this kind of trouble. I'm curious what this says about our professional sports system. Also, we live in the age of surveillance. We saw it solve the Boston Marathon bombing investigation. And here's Hernandez in what seems like very strong circumstantial case built on videotapes, including videotapes from his own home. Who wants to take this? Jerry Seib, what do you make of this?
Well, two thoughts. I mean, anybody who in America who doesn't realize by now that there are surveillance cameras everywhere has not been paying attention. They've been sleeping in a cave. Think about the Boston Marathon bombing. And by the way, you know, that was a case where most Americans were happy there were surveillance cameras. So I think there's, you know, the question that there's too much surveillance depends on the circumstances. And in a lot of cases, people are happy that there is. That's reaction number one. Reaction number two, I think, is probably a fairly universal one and applies to lots of well-paid athletes. It's just, what are they thinking? You know, I mean, why? Why does it? Why? Why behave this way? So much going for you. So many things broke right. Why?
Bill McKenzie, your view? In about the 10 seconds that remain.
Right. I think sports, and I'm a sports fan, I think we just are growing in industries of people who, you know, we have a Dallas Cowboy player who's charged with manslaughter. And, you know, at what point do we as fans stop yelling for these people, for these teams? That's the question, I guess, because we're helping defeat it, myself included.
Well, we'll end there because our time is upon us. Bill McKenzie, thanks to you. He's editorial columnist with Dallas Morning News. Thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you all.
And Jerry Seib, Washington Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal, where he writes the Capital Journal column. Thank you, Jerry.
Happy to be with you.
And Jack Beatty, as always, a pleasure. Many thanks to you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.